also pledged to work with Israel to loosen the 3-year blockade on Gaza. Meanwhile, in the region, Egyptian authorities have decided to keep the Rafah crossing terminal open indefinitely for the first time in 3 years. The decision comes in the wake of a storm of international criticism against Israel following the deadly Israeli Navy attack on a Gaza aid convoy last week. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari files this report.
Jamila Hamouda is a mother of 5 children. On Wednesday, she waited on the Gaza side of the Rafah crossing, hoping to finally see her family in Cairo for the first time in 15 years.
In the past, I followed all the necessary procedures, but I have so far failed to cross. God willing, this time it will work. We've heard about buses of people being allowed through on a humanitarian basis. I do wonder how they decide these cases, as I consider my case to be a humanitarian one.
The Egyptian Foreign Ministry says they will open the crossing indefinitely, yet border crossing authorities in the Hamas-led government say that some travelers have been turned back by Egyptian authorities. They confirm that the same arrangements for travel are still valid, but not all Gazans can cross. Only students, patients, and people with residency permits in neighboring Arab countries are being let through. Egypt has previously insisted that in order to fully open the Rafah crossing, Hamas needs to meet conditions of a 2005 American mediated agreement in which the Palestinian Authority would return to power in Gaza. Dr. Ghazi Hamad is head of the Border Crossings Department at the Hamas-led government.
We want a compromise between us and our brothers in Fatah in order to participate the administration of Rafah crossings, because I think, as you said, first of all, we have to finish the division. We have to restore the national unity and to restore the reconciliation, because I think after that the world will respect us.
Asked by FSRN whether the Egyptian move is meant to exert more pressure on Hamas to shut down underground tunnels, Hamad said the tunnels are a last resort.
Look, if Rafah crossing is opened and it is open for the commercial thing, for the passenger, we don't need tunnels, because if tunnels mean catastrophe, disaster for us, death of people, more victims. So I think really we speak loudly. We want the crossing to be opened. We want to work on the ground and not under the ground.
Meanwhile, a Palestinian Authority official said some previously forbidden goods will be allowed in Gaza starting next week, including carbonated drinks, fruit, and chips. According to Agence France-Presse, an Israeli spokesperson said that decision was made before last week's flotilla attack. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. The time is 7:01, time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. For Billy Bond, for the best, expect the worst. Understood, but did we know?
Good evening, everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening with another exciting action-packed edition of Off the Hook. Joined tonight by Mike.
Hi.
Jim.
Hello.
Red Hack.
Hello.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Dot Rhett.
Hello.
RNA.
Hey.
And down in Philadelphia, Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia.
Well, as the fundraiser draws to a close, tonight is, in fact, the last night for us. I have some sad news. We're not going to be here next week, because next week is Bloomsday, and that's when you get to hear Ulysses read over the radio waves every June 16th.
Just thrilling.
It is thrilling. No, it's a BAI tradition, and I'm honored to be preempted by it, but unfortunately it always seems to happen on a Wednesday.
That can't be.
Well, I don't know. Look it up. It seems to happen all the time.
Wouldn't it be once every 7 years or so?
Point is, this is the fifth straight week of fundraising, and the first week where we weren't going to be fundraising, we're not going to be on. But I have good news to make up for the bad news, and that is that on July 7th, which is 1 week and 2 days before Hope, we have a two-hour show, thanks to the generosity of the personal computer people. They've yielded their hour to us. We'll have a special two-hour event on Off the Hook on July 7th from 8 to 10. From 7 to 9, I'm sorry.
You fooled me.
A few years ago, yes. There's that. And yes, as we mentioned, tonight is a fundraising night once more, one last time. And we have something really, really, really special this time to give away. Actually, you know what? Why don't we just plunge right into it? I think we should do that because we have all kinds of other things to talk about tonight. And we might get involved in a discussion that will just get impassioned and go on for a long time. So I'd like to introduce people to something that is being released very, very shortly. And it's something brand new. It's something we have never talked about before. Does anybody have any inkling as to what I'm talking about? No? Bernie, no?
It better not be the fourth generation iPhone, because I don't want one.
Well, no, and if it was, I don't think we'd be able to get much of a response from our listeners to that. But it's the new 2600 book. Yes, you heard right. There is a brand new 2600 book. Has not yet come out, but it's going to come out very, very soon. And what we're offering people tonight for a pledge of $75 is an autographed copy of that book. The book is called Dear Hacker. Yes, Dear Hacker. And what that is, it's a compilation of the best 2600 letters ever to appear. Now, 2600 Magazine, the Hacker Quarterly, has a tradition of printing letters to the editor in abundance because we get so many letters to the editor. And some of them are really kind of funny and crazy and wacky. And what we did for the past few months was basically go through all of them. Actually, this was almost a year's worth of work. Voltaire was involved in this, and all kinds of people read through letters and came up with great ideas for what would work and what wouldn't. We divided it into several sections. You guys, you have some drafts of some chapters there. What are some of the sections that you have? It's said in big type at the front. That's
The title of the chapter.
Yes, the chapter.
Tales from the Retail Front is
Tales
the,
from the Retail. That's a chapter all about stores. People write in
People's
saying
interaction with stores. Or
this
if
is
they
what I did
at
Blockbuster
store.
Today. This is what happened at Radio Shack when I annoyed the clerk. You know, basically technical things that people reveal about the retail world. Rob, what do you have?
I have our biggest fans.
That's my favorite section. Well, I'll explain what that's all about in a little bit. Dot Red, what do you have?
Chapter one. Question upon question.
Okay, don't give away the chapter numbers. Just the names.
Fine, it's chapter 100.
Spoilers. You can't tell people where they are. Well, question upon question. That is basically people asking us all manner of questions.
Yes.
And RNA, you have one too.
I have a culture of rebels.
Culture of rebels. Okay, that's not what it sounds like. I don't want people to panic here. It's rebel in with the capital, the small lowercase r.
It's a capital R on this thing that I'm seeing.
That's because it's a title, but that's why it's capital there. No, it's not rebel the caller.
You mean he didn't write enough letters in?
I'm sure there's a letter. I don't know if there is a letter from him, actually.
Intellectual rebels.
If you ever wrote a letter to 2600, there's a good chance that it's contained here.
Well, if it was a good letter.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of them are. A lot of them are. We're going to read some excerpts. Ulysses has nothing on us because what we're going to read this Wednesday is really going to make history. And what we're offering two things tonight. Actually, three things. We're going to count the shirt. For pledges of 35 and above, you get an off-the-hook T-shirt.
I think we should count that.
Okay, yeah. And then for a pledge of $75, you get the T-shirt plus the brand new Dear Hacker book. And I think it's about 600 pages or so, and hardcover. It's really, really pretty cool. For a pledge of $125, you get all of that. You get the T-shirt, the Dear Hacker book, and a full archive of Off the Hook episodes from 1988 to the end of 2009. We've been playing some excerpts. Maybe we'll have time to play an excerpt later on of that huge DVD set. So that's a really good deal, and it would do us well to get some calls on this, our very last night of fundraising. And I think we've fundraised more on this marathon than ever before. We've never done 5 weeks in a row. So make us look good, folks, by calling 212-209-2950 and pledging whatever you can afford, pledging for those premiums, and getting some really cool stuff.
So you this is your second book. You wrote a book before, which is a collection of the articles, but this is a brand new book.
I compiled the book. I mean, I wrote the okay. intros and the summaries and things like that, and of course the letter responses. So I guess in this particular case, I did write a lot of it. But due credit has to go to all the people in the two books who wrote articles and wrote letters and things like that.
But that's an important point. But the point I was making is that this is brand new. So if you have the other book, this is not the same book.
This is not the same book. No, we would not put out the same book twice. This is something that people have long asked for, and if you have the best of 2600, which is the book we put out a couple of years ago, you don't have a single letter in that entire 800 and change page book. Not one letter made it in there. Those are just articles. There's a whole other section of the magazine just devoted to letters to the editor. And it's the favorite section of most people who read the magazine. They love reading the letters because, well, we're going to show why. Rob, why don't you start? You've got my favorite section,
yes,
which
do.
Is our biggest fans. And the reason I call it our favorite section is because these are people that are angry with us for one reason or another. And they're spouting forth with venom, and lots of times it gets very engaging as far as how hostile they are. Sometimes we have fun with that. Sometimes we try and explain things. Sometimes they're completely correct in being angry at us. We might have done something horrible to them at some point. Read us a selection from our biggest fans.
Okay, here's a neat one, a nice little sign of the times from 1987. Here it goes. Dear 2600, I am convinced that as a result of your mailing 2600 without envelopes, many innocent people will be arrested and charged with crimes that they have not committed. Your statement that 2600 is not illegal, etc., is only true on the part of 2600 publishers, but you want to imply that no envelopes will not harm your subscribers. This is not true. Let me remind you how the criminal justice system works. You are innocent until proven guilty, but even if you are innocent, if some creep suspects that you are not innocent, it could cost you $100,000 to prove in court that you are indeed innocent. And that's from Newark, New Jersey. And the response is, we respect your opinion, but why did you have to send us those comments on a postcard so that the whole post office could read it?
Yes, that's typical of the kind of thing that would happen. Dabrit, what do you have? You have a question, I believe. Question upon question from that chapter.
This one. Yeah, yes. Here we go. How is it possible? Well, I'm sorry. Let me back up a second. This is from 1989.
Okay.
Yeah, all right, now.
212-209-2950. Call up and get this book, which you'll read a lot faster than Dot Red is reading.
Dear 2600, how is it possible to publish hacking and freaking information without those authorities changing those systems that you expose?
Ooh.
Yeah.
So people were concerned about us exposing systems. And, yeah, that's a valid concern. Did we answer that?
Yes. Yes, we did.
What's the answer?
The answer was... good question. Sometimes the systems are changed. Sometimes systems are not. You know, but we get out.
Did you forget how to read?
I forgot how to read for a second. I am sorry, but we get out of it. I'm sorry.
Okay,
what we get out of it is knowledge.
All right. Well, you know, I think you need to get some more knowledge out of it.
And it's an invaluable tool which leads us to figuring out more about them. In other words, knowledge for information are always advantageous and should never be stifled.
As you can see, this book has a tremendous effect on people and makes them totally forget their senses sometimes.
I imagine it's beautifully typeset. You can read it no problem once you get a copy.
Usually. Red Hack, what do you have?
I actually have a letter from 1995.
What section do you
have? Oh, I'm sorry. I have the Tales from the Retail.
Tales from Retail. Oh, yeah. This is a good section, too.
And I have a letter from 1995, which is basically talking about, I'll just read it, I guess.
We have two calls on the line, by the way. Join those two callers, 212-209-2950. Get a copy of this book, $75 pledge, or $125 for the audio archive as well.
Says, I was in Radio Shack the other day and bought a 43141 modem pocket tone dialer. It was the last one they had, and they had it on sale for $7. The next day, I came in and tried to buy a 6.5536 megahertz crystal.
Uh-oh.
The guy looked on my account on the computer and saw that I'd purchased the pocket dialer. He asked what I needed the crystal for, and I told him that my dad needed it for a scanner. Then I saw a sign on the service desk that had a picture of the Radio Shack president, and it said that they only wanted your phone number and address for sending out catalogs. I asked the guy about it, and he said that he couldn't sell me the crystal. So the sign is just crap, I said. And he said that they also keep records to monitor possible illegal activities.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So, I was wondering if I might possibly have a case of false advertising or something if I get the guy's voice on tape telling me that when the sign says they want your info... telling me that when the sign says that they just want your info for the catalog.
Okay. And now, this harkens back to the old Redbox days.
Yeah, so basically he was trying to build, you know, take the pocket dialer and the crystal and combine them to...
Wait, you're assuming. You're making the same mistake the Radio Shack employee was making.
But it's interesting because he's pointing out that Radio Shack, even though they say they just want to send you the catalog, mm-hmm. they're actually tracking your purchases, like most chains do nowadays. I mean, when use that little, you know... rewards card at any chain.
Of course, yeah.
They're tracking your purchases.
And
they're
people don't seem to mind anymore.
They're not just giving you discounts.
Yeah, back then, what year is this again?
1995.
People were kind of shocked by that. But the crystal was used, you basically inserted it into the Radio Shack dialer, and you had a device that made the five little beeps, and those five little beeps told a payphone that you had put a quarter in. It was so simple, and that is how the entire phone system of this country was crippled for many, many years, or the payphone system, that is. And Radio Shack, of course, we revealed the information in 2600 magazine. In fact, it might have been in a letter, or no, actually it was an article. Someone wrote an article about it, but we talked about it many times in letters. And that resulted in quite a few changes in the entire system. To go back to that other letter that asked, our systems changed when things are revealed.
But that had to be like a hardware change, right? Because they had to mute the handset.
Yeah, they had to do all that. They had to install this new software called mm-hmm. Mars, I believe. And now payphones don't use those tones anymore. But it was that easy. All you had to do was beep five times, and that told the system.
It worked for a long time, though, because I remember in the early 2000s, I was able to use that.
Every payphone had to be replaced. No, of course not. Every single payphone had to be replaced, though. People were using Hallmark greeting cards and recording Redbox tones onto them, holding them up to payphones. It was that easy to fool them. So, yeah, it's just funny to go back into even the 90s and see how different things were then. Now, we only are reading letters from the first 10 or so years, because I only printed out the first 10 pages of various chapters. But this goes from 1984, our first year, all the way up to last year, I believe. It's all part of this book.
You issued the first issue of 2600. Did that have letters in it already?
Well, no. How would that have letters
in it? Right, I'm just asking. So when did they start?
A few issues after that. Yeah. I think maybe three issues after that we got our first letter.
Right.
We printed our first letter anyway. It just got bigger and bigger. And the reason it got bigger and bigger is because in the hacker world, people love to go back and forth. They love to have dialogue and exchanges and trade information and get feedback to the information they just traded. And so the 2600 letter section became the forum for this. It was actually, I think, the first real hacker forum, in print. It might be the only one in print. It just became extremely popular, and to this day we get hundreds of letters for every single issue we put out, and we have to pick and choose because there are so many, and I guess we could put out a book of all the ones that didn't make it, but these are the ones that did that we think are the best, and it's all yours. This brand new book, which is about to come out, autograph copy, 212-209-2950, pledge of $75 gets you that and the off the hook T-shirt. If you want the off-the-hook audio archive on top of that, which is about 20 DVDs filled with audio from our first show back in 1988 to our last one at the end of 2009. Pledge $125, you'll get that, you'll get the book, you'll get the T-shirt. 212-209-2950.
And the radio station.
And the radio station, yes.
That's really the premium.
That's right. All right, RNA, you have one to read that too.
I have from A Culture of Rebels.
Culture of Rebels.
Yes.
All right, that's the scary chapter.
Yeah. The writer starts out by saying the following is a true story. And, it's 04-01-85, so 1985.
Okay.
The phone rang. I got up and looked at the desk clock. It was 6:08 a.m., an hour before I go to school. I picked the receiver up. Is this John McKee? Asked the caller urgently. Yes, I replied, half asleep. You better get rid of your printouts and your stuff on disks. You're gonna get a visit within the next 20 minutes, the kid said. He hung up. I got nervous. The phone rang again. John, this is Jim. Greg just got busted, and his brother's been calling all of his friends on a sheet that Greg had. Did he call you? Yes, he did, I said. You better believe it, because you're going to get nailed with the rest of us. Get rid of everything. Burn it. I thought to myself, what did I do to make them want me? Codes? No time. Have to burn everything pertaining to illegal wrongdoings. I was panic-stricken. I got it all together and went outside and burned it. Discs, printouts, everything. As I was returning to my house, I wondered if they had a tap on my line. The phone rang again. Oh no, who is it now? I went in and answered it, only to be told, April Fools. Click.
Yeah. Wow. The thing is, back then, that kind of thing happened all the time.
Yeah.
People were always getting raided. The feds were coming to people's homes, kicking in doors and taking floppies and printouts and things like that, computers and phones.
Crazy
even.
Time.
Every teenage kid who was involved with computers lived in fear of that happening to them. So this was not something that was that surprising to get a phone call like that.
Yeah.
But that's part of the memories that that you'll get to read about if you pledge for this book. We have no calls on the line. Bernie, do your magic. Get some calls coming in.
Well, that brings back lots of memories, Emmanuel. And a question for you. About how many pages is this new book?
It's about 600, I believe. 600 and change.
Wow. 600-some pages of letters to 2600 magazine. That's, you know, it's really great material reading back these letters because, first of all, the responses, the letters themselves, and often the responses are pretty humorous. But it's sort of like a time machine going back and giving the perspective of decades of what's been going on in the hacker community, kind of like this radio show does too, which is why we're providing the archives tonight of all the episodes of Off the Hook going back to 1988?
That's right, yes. Our first
show. Amazing. So I encourage our listeners to get their historical perspective by calling 212-209-2950 for a mere $35, you get the newly designed Off the Hook T-shirt by Rob T. Firefly, which is a very cool telephonic design. But for $75 pledge, you get that shirt and this book we've been talking about, 600-some pages of stimulating letters and responses. For $125, you get both the book and the shirt and all the Off the Hook episodes going back to 1988. It's really an amazing package, but the biggest package is WBAI, which is probably the only radio station in the country or the world that would provide you with a radio show about this kind of stuff. So please call 212-209-2950 and support this kind of broadcast, which you're not going to hear anywhere else.
Now, we know that you're worn out. We're worn out as well. We've been doing this now. This is our fifth week fundraising. It's our last week fundraising. And I think we were on for 5 weeks because we've done well in the past, and we need to keep that tradition up. The important thing is that that the radio station be here for future generations to converse and trade information, just like the 2600 letters have done over the last few decades. 212-209-2950. We're still looking for our first call in this particular batch, and so far it has not come in. 212-209-2950. I should point out this book is only being offered for this hour. We have not offered it before, and as this is the last fundraising day that we're going to be doing, we're not going to offer it again. So this is your chance to get an autographed copy of Dear Hacker, the brand new book about 2,600 letters and dialogue of the hacker community. If you want to see what hackers were saying, this is the next best thing to logging onto a BBS, which you can't do anymore. They're not around. except maybe Jason Scott has some in his collection. But other than that, it's very hard to access this. And this is making it accessible to everybody.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that it may seem strange to some people today, but for those of us who were around back then, the letters page of a magazine is how that community conversed back and forth in really slow conversations going from issue to issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was before the widespread use of the internet. Not even all the computer geeks had computers yet. And this was sometimes the only way that you could get these sort of ideas and questions answered. And it was it's really something. And strangely enough, it's somehow still going on today in the letters page of the magazine.
It is. It's a tradition. And we have four calls on the line. That's great to see, because that tells me that people care and that it does matter to them. And, you know, I get the same feeling every time I read the letters. It tells me that people are out there. They care. They have something to say. And we're there to listen, to respond, to be part of the dialogue. That's what's the amazing thing about both the magazine and the radio station have always been, is just the ability for people to go back and forth and be heard. So many people have had their first letter ever that they've written to anything published in 2600. And that's a, I don't know if everyone here has had something published someplace. It's an amazing feeling to actually see your words in print. And I know we've made a lot of people very happy just by printing what they say. And of course, if we have a particularly witty retort to them, that makes them even happier, maybe even angrier, who knows. But the important thing is it's history. It's there forever, and it's part of this book. 212-209-2950. Again, a pledge of $75 gets you the book, autographed copy of Dear Hacker, the collection of 2,600 letters, along with the off-the-hook T-shirt in the size of your choice. A pledge of $125 gets you all of that, plus a full archive of Off the Hook from 1988 to the end of 2009. That's, Mike, is it thousands of hours? Is it?
It's so many hours that you don't even need to know how many.
It's a lot of hours. It really is. 212-209-2950. Join the four callers on the line. I saw a fifth caller just came in, but it's possible the phone wasn't picked up in time. And if that's the case, just call right back, because it will be. There's people there that definitely want to pick up the phone. 212-209-2950. That is our phone number. I'll say if we get one more call, we'll go to our big story of the night. And it is a pretty big story, and we want to devote some time to it since we won't be here next week. All right.
Who's the most famous letter author in the book?
Most famous letter author in the book?
There must be someone who went on to become famous. Or
well, I know Cory Doctorow wrote. I think he wrote an article. I'm not sure what issue that's in. And I'm not sure if that even was in the Best of 2600. But I'm sure there are other famous people that have written in without revealing who they are. Because if you're famous, you're not going to say, oh, by the way, this is Brad Pitt.
And, people sign letters.
Yeah, but do they sign letters to 2600 other than with a handle or something?
Oh, they might. I guess not.
I mean, he might have been, you know, Snow Monster of the North or something. That could have been his handle.
Did you out Brad Pitt?
Oh, well, no, not knowingly anyway. As far as I know, Angelina didn't write us any letters, I don't think. But yes, go ahead, Bernie. We have six calls on the line, so that's great to see. 212-209. No, make that 7. 212-209-2950. This book is going to fly off the shelves when it does come out, and you'll be one of the first people to actually have your own autographed copy of it. It's really going to be pretty cool. Go ahead, Bernie.
I just wanted to say, I always find it amusing when people write in. They use just interesting nicknames or handles, like you just mentioned, because they're really afraid that just. The publication of their name along with their question could get them in hot water. That's the type of questions that are answered in this book back over the decades. So it's really, I just find it fascinating, you know, people writing in about they're afraid that just the magazine getting mailed to their home would get them on some government hit list or God forbid, if their name was seen in print along with a question for asking forbidden information. It's really interesting. It's just the kind of questions that people ask and the answers they get make this really a worthwhile thing to get. So I encourage our listeners to call 212-209-2950 and read all the questions that people are really afraid to ask that they wouldn't even put their name to them. 212-209-2950. For $75, you get this book of 600 pages of forbidden questions and the Off the Hook T-shirt, freshly designed by Rob T. Firefly. And if you want to hear all the Off the Hook episodes going back to 1988, a pledge of $125 will get you the book and the shirt and 20 DVDs full of MP3s with high-quality audio of all the shows.
Amazing.
212-209-2950 for a huge amount of information. But like I said, the biggest premium is WBAI, the only radio station I know of. It would broadcast this kind of information. 212-209-2950.
And you just reminded me, too, we were talking about famous people writing in. Actually, Bernie, you wrote a few letters before we actually knew who you were. You wrote a bunch of letters to 2600.
I guess I did. I think the first time I wrote in was probably back in 85, 86 or something. It might have been something about cellular phones.
Yes, in fact, it was. I think that's one of the letters that made it into the book. I'm pretty sure it did. In fact, several of your letters are in the book.
Yeah, I think I had a gripe that several pages of the magazine were filled with of all the cellular telephone frequencies, and I thought, well, hey,
I can't believe you remember that. Yes, you remember what got you upset back in the 80s.
You made a good point that the first time your letter is published in 2600, it makes a big impression. I still remember this was like decades ago, but I just put together a quick formula for a little program in BASIC you could write. It's like a 3-line program that would allow you to either enter the the frequency or the channel or the cellular telephone channel, and it would give you the other the frequency of the channel, and then you could listen to phone calls on your scanner.
And as I remember it, our witty retort to you was that, okay, if you do that, if you have that particular formula, what are you going to do? You're going to print out the list. So we basically save people a step by printing the list in the first place.
You made a good point. So that's the kind of stuff that, you, I mean, some good witty retorts to, you know, so, or like Mad Magazine used to have a great section, snappy answers to stupid questions.
And they were a big inspiration to us, along with other publications as well. Rob, you have something?
I've actually got that letter in question right here.
We have it.
By Bernie S.
Wow. Is it as we say it was?
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much, okay. Well, it's a fresher on my memory. I'm very impressed that Bernie remembers it because he hasn't been editing the book for the last few months. But, yeah, that's just part of the magic that you'll get. If you call 212-209-2950, pledge 75 for the book, autographed copy of the book, Dear Hacker, and 125, get the book and the archive of Off the Hook. 212-209-2950. Okay, let's move on to a story that has been all over the place in recent days. This comes off of Wired. Federal officials have arrested an Army intelligence analyst who boasted of giving classified U.S. combat video and hundreds of thousands of classified State Department records to whistleblower site WikiLeaks. SPC Bradley Manning of Potomac, Maryland, was stationed at Forward Operating Base Hammer, 40 miles east of Baghdad, when he was arrested nearly 2 weeks ago by the Army's Criminal Investigation Division. A family member says he's being held in custody in Kuwait and has not been formally charged. He was turned in late last month by a former computer hacker with whom he spoke online. In the course of their chats, Manning took credit for leaking a headline-making video of a helicopter attack that WikiLeaks posted online in April. That video showed a deadly 2007 U.S. helicopter airstrike in Baghdad that claimed the lives of several innocent civilians. And if you recall, we had the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, on our radio station, on our show, a day or two after this came out. And in fact, he's also going to be one of our keynote speakers at the Next Hope this July. So, wow, this is hitting pretty close to home already. Now, this guy, this Army guy, said that he also leaked three other items to WikiLeaks, a separate video showing the notorious 2009 Guarani airstrike in Afghanistan that WikiLeaks has previously acknowledged is in its possession, a classified Army document evaluating WikiLeaks as a security threat, which the site posted in March, and a previously unreported breach consisting of 260,000 classified U.S. diplomatic cables that Manning described as exposing almost criminal political back dealings. This is what he said. Hillary Clinton and several thousand diplomats around the world are going to have a heart attack when they wake up one morning and find an entire repository of classified foreign policy is available in searchable format to the public. Now, Wired could not confirm whether WikiLeaks received the supposed 260,000 classified embassy dispatches. To date, a single classified diplomatic cable has appeared on the site. Released last February, it describes a U.S. embassy meeting with the government of Iceland. Manning's arrest comes as WikiLeaks has ratcheted up pressure against various governments over the years with embarrassing documents acquired through a global whistleblower network that is seemingly impervious to threats from adversaries. Yeah, its operations are hosted on servers in several countries. It uses high-level encryption for its document submission process, providing secure anonymity for its sources and a safe haven from legal repercussions for itself. And since its launch in 2006, it has never outed a source through its own actions, either voluntarily or involuntarily. Now, Manning came to the attention of the FBI and Army investigators after he contacted former hacker Adrian Lamo late last month over instant messenger and email. Lamo had just been the subject of another Wired article, and very quickly in his exchange with Lamo, Manning claimed to be the WikiLeaks video leaker. Now, from the chat logs that were provided by Lamo and examined by Wired, it appears Manning sensed a kindred spirit in the ex-hacker. He discussed personal issues that got him into trouble with his superiors and left him socially isolated, and said he had been demoted and was headed for an early discharge from the Army. Now, when Manning told Lamo that he leaked a quarter of a million classified embassy cables, Lamo contacted the Army and then met with Army CID investigators and the FBI at a Starbucks near his house in Carmichael, California, where he passed the agents a copy of the chat logs. At their second meeting, FBI agents from the Oakland field office told the hacker that Manning had been arrested the day before. Lamo has contributed funds to WikiLeaks in the past and says he agonized over the decision to expose Manning. He says he's frequently contacted by hackers who want to talk about their adventures, and he has never considered reporting anyone before. The supposed diplomatic cable leak, however, made him believe Manning's actions were genuinely dangerous to U.S. national security. Now, interesting quote here from Manning. He said that the networks that he had access to contained, quote, incredible things, awful things that belonged in the public domain and not on some server stored in a dark room in Washington, D.C. He has an interesting way of speaking sometimes. I'll read a couple more quotes. But basically, the video, the thing that everybody was talking about a couple of months ago, was released by WikiLeaks under the title Collateral Murder. It shows a 2007 Army helicopter attack on a group of men, some of whom were armed, that the soldiers believe were insurgents. The attack killed two Reuters employees and an unarmed Baghdad man who stumbled on the scene afterward and tried to rescue one of the wounded by pulling him into his van. The man's two children were in the van and suffered serious injuries in the hail of gunfire. One of the friends of Manning, Tyler Watkins from Boston, said he wanted to do the right thing. That was something I think he was struggling with. He would message me, are people talking about it? Are the media saying anything? That was one of his major concerns, that once he had done this, once he had released the videos, was it really going to make a difference? He didn't want to do this just to cause a stir. He wanted people held accountable and wanted to see that this didn't happen again. Now, the second video he claimed to have leaked shows a May 2009 strike near Gurani Village in Afghanistan that the local government says killed nearly 100 civilians, most of them children. The Pentagon released a report about the incident, but backed down on a plan to show the video. Manning had access to two classified networks from two separate secured laptops, SuperNet, the secret-level network used by the Department of Defense and the State Department, and the Joint Worldwide Intelligence Communication System, which serves both agencies at the top secret / SCI level. Manning told Lamo that the Gurani video was left accessible in a directory on a U.S. Central Command server, centcom.smil.mil, by officers who investigated the incident. The video, he said, was an encrypted AES-256 zip file. Everywhere there's a U.S. post, Manning said, there's a diplomatic scandal that will be revealed. It's open diplomacy, worldwide anarchy in CSV format. It's climate gate with a global scope and breathtaking depth. It's beautiful and horrifying. Well, this guy has a way with the sound bites, I'll say that. But boy, this is something that that really has hit the fan big time. For one thing, Adrian Lamo is associated with 2600 on a number of levels, has been on this show and has an account on our machine, and runs the Facebook site for 2600, Facebook group. And I think that might be one of the reasons why we were flooded yesterday with attacks on our site, even though we had no knowledge of any of this. And of course, Julian Assange is our keynote speaker, or one of our keynote speakers, at the Next Hope in July. So we're seeing it from both ends here. The question is, did Adrian Lamo do the right thing by turning in this guy? Jim, you're shaking your head.
No?
Okay. What do you say, Mike?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to use the word allegedly in almost every sentence there.
Yes.
We have no evidence. This is basically a single-sourced article. We have no evidence that anyone told Adrian Lamo this.
My question was about Adrian Lamo, if he did the right thing.
Well, so it's just assuming, for argument's sake, that the story is reported accurately and that Adrian at least honestly believed that this guy was the WikiLeaks leaker, whether or not even that is true.
Mm-hmm.
I think that whoever sent these documents to WikiLeaks really ought to be commended. I think that as the people who funded the production of these killings and funded the production of these documents, we have the right to know about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I don't think that was the reason that he felt compelled to turn him in. I think when he heard that there were 260,000 diplomatic...
this is one of the reasons I wanted to use the word allegedly a lot, because WikiLeaks says they have no such thing in their possession.
And there has been quite a Twitter war going on between WikiLeaks and Wired as far as this.
WikiLeaks is
accusing both Adrian Lamo and Kevin Paulsen, who wrote the article, of being convicted felons that you can't trust. And Wired is writing back with all kinds of other responses to that. It's and of course, you know, we're getting pink flooded off the net in the process. So it's all kinds of open warfare going on the internet right now concerning this. But I think reading some of the commentary, almost universally, it seems a lot of people are condemning what Adrian Lamo did. And I'm just wondering if that's completely fair. Red Hack.
You also have to take into account that WikiLeaks doesn't just take things in and then publish them immediately. There is an amount of editorial discretion that goes into it. So, you know, I think that generally, it seems that their concern is to kind of shake things up and people who wouldn't otherwise be held accountable for things to be held accountable. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that they would go so far, you know, as to do things that would maybe put other people's lives in danger. So I think, you know, allegedly Adrian Lamo's concern was that, you know, people would be endangered by this kind of information being out there. Mm-hmm. But WikiLeaks, at the same time, you know, I think in a way they're trying to help and they're trying to get things out there that should be out there, but they probably have some amount of discretion.
Okay, go ahead, Mike.
People's lives are endangered by the suppression of U.S. government information. People's lives are put in danger because Americans, by and large, don't know that their government kills journalists in Iraq.
But they do now. They know now.
And hopefully this will, it's a long process.
Can you say the same thing about 260,000 classified documents, that they're not going to put people's lives in danger if they're released?
I mean, if these documents even exist, then I don't know what's in them. So it's hard to say.
That's an interesting thing, too, because this guy said he had 260,000 documents. I don't know if that was just posturing in the hacker world. Believe it or not, there is a lot of posturing. If you read the letters book, you'll see that. And in this particular case, I don't know for sure if he was just making that up. There is no real evidence.
We don't even know for sure that he said that. Again, it's a single-sourced article.
Well, again, there are chat logs, allegedly, unless that's not true. Well, no, you haven't seen them, but... okay, well, I mean, I don't know how big you would think a conspiracy is here.
It doesn't require conspiracy at all. It requires Adrian to be not telling the truth. And I don't know that he isn't.
If he received a chat from somebody in the Army saying that he just released 260,000 confidential messages to a WikiLeaks site, would that be something that you would be concerned with if you saw that? If you got a message like that from somebody, would you trust that all those messages weren't going to cause any kind of damage by being released?
I think
it was an impossible situation he was put in. If all the facts are what we're being led to believe they are, what's being reported in this story. Go ahead, Rob.
Emmanuel.
Rob first, then Bernie, then Dot Red.
I would like to say that, you know, I don't know Adrian Lamo on any kind of personal level, but I'm familiar with some of the things he's done and some of the things he's written and so on, and his case and what have you. But I am pretty sure that he's not a stupid person. Going into this and making the decision that he did, he knew what the consequences would be, not only among the hacker community or among the government or what have you. I think he was pretty much able to see what would happen once he did this, and then he did it. So whatever caused him to take this as his to make this decision to act in this way, I think he knew what was coming, and so he had to be really sure. And I don't know what was going on in his head or what was going on in anyone else's head, and I don't know the situation any more than was written on that page. But I think that it's worth considering that he really believed he was doing the right thing. And hopefully we'll hear more from anyone on that side of the story, and we can get some.
If you just ask yourself the question, what would you do in that situation, and give yourself 5 seconds to answer it, and if you're able to do that, ask yourself why you're so sure that you went one way or the other, because I know I'm not. It'll take me a while to figure out what to do.
I also know that if I were the person who leaked such material, I would not be bragging about it to anybody.
That's the thing. This guy, the intellect on him, it's... yeah, this is what people do. They brag about things.
WikiLeaks exists so people can do this without it becoming known who they were.
And it's one thing to find a video that exposes the military as liars and killers and things like that. That I think is commendable, and that's something that we owe him a great debt for getting the truth out as far as that goes. But if you're going to just release everything without even knowing what it is, that's irresponsible. And if you're going to say that you did something that you didn't do, that's irresponsible as well. And I think that's what he's paying the price for mostly. Now, there's one thing that's interesting. It strikes me as interesting here. Maybe somebody can answer this. But when the video file is referred to here, they say it was an encrypted AES 256 zip file that he found in somebody's directory. What I want to know is, how did he know what it was then if it was encrypted? Does anybody know the answer to that?
It's probably named as what, to what
named
it was.
Named soldiers killing civilians?
I don't know. It might have had the location and the date in the name.
Maybe.
And then you could put two and two together and say, well, this event happened on that date at that location.
I guess if they log everything in that. But I mean, if they understand the system, that's
true. We know that with the other video that was released by WikiLeaks, they did have to do a fair amount of work to actually get the video.
They had to decrypt the zip file.
Right.
Yes, it was encrypted.
So it was encrypted. So I'm sure the same situation held, you know, that they knew it. He knew it was in that, probably for the same reason.
But you see, he didn't decrypt it. The people at WikiLeaks decrypted it, so he didn't know for sure what it was he was giving them. That's what I don't get.
Here's the thing. Think about it. If you're a government organization, you probably want to know what every file – I mean, you're assuming the security of the file is the fact that nobody has access to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's encrypted, but also the fact that it's on this, you know, secure network. And so, you know, what they're – you still want to keep track of it. You want to know where this file is. So I'm sure they named it in a way that said, okay, well, this is so-and-so event that we were investigating.
Just one of many questions that I have about all this. I hope the truth comes out. Bernie, go ahead.
Oh, to answer your question, Bradley Manning, the military official who allegedly leaked this video, reportedly told Adrian Lamo that in addition to the file name, that the location of the file raised red flags for him. It was in the folder of a judge advocate general. That's like a military attorney's folder. So that in and of itself would indicate that the contents of this video file was of concern to the military.
Is this a TV show? He actually went into that judge's directory and he's able to see all the sensitive cases because it's in a folder called Sensitive Cases? Wow.
I don't know. But
this is our military. This is how they run things.
So, but back to your other question, you know, would you do this if you were in Adrian Lamo's shoes? I believe Adrian Lamo is an honorable and honest person. However, his motivations may be different from other people. If I were in his shoes, knowing what I know now, I would not have contacted the Army and said, hey, this guy just told me he released 260,000 classified diplomatic cables to WikiLeaks. However, it's insightful to know that it's a federal crime to not have done what Adrian Lamo did. In other words, there's a federal felony under Title 18 called misprision of a felony. And what that means is, I'll just read the statute here. It says, whoever, having knowledge of the actual commission of a felony cognizable by a court of the United States, conceals and does not as soon as possible make known the same to some judge or other person in civil or military authority under the United States, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 3 years, or both. So Adrian Lamo was probably still under government surveillance because he spent some time in federal prison not too long ago, a few years ago. It would not be surprising if he's still under surveillance. And with the way this military guy was shooting his mouth off and bragging to more than one person, reportedly, that he'd released these files to WikiLeaks, it's not inconceivable to think that Adrian Lamo would have thought, well, this kid's going to get himself busted, and it's going to show up in this kid's files that he was communicating this information to me, and then I'm going to go to prison as well. So I'm not justifying what Adrian Lamo did, but it's useful to know that Adrian probably knew that he was likely to go to prison for not revealing this information. I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying that's information we should know.
Okay. Well, one thing that's interesting is that both of these guys might be coming to the same conference in July here in New York. We're not exactly sure yet if that's actually going to happen. And in fact, I know that there's a lot of question now as to whether or not Julian would be safe coming to this country in light of all the heat that's coming down as a result of WikiLeaks being in the news. And the last thing we want to do, of course, is put somebody in harm's way as far as being exposed to hostile governments that really wouldn't be very happy with the things that he's exposed through WikiLeaks. So one way or another, though, we do promise he will be speaking to the conference, hopefully in person. And if not in some way, we will make this happen. But safety is paramount above all else. And especially, if you think I'm kidding about this, this is a story that showed up in the Sunday Times in London. NATO is considering the use of military force against enemies who launch cyber attacks on its member states. Yes. The move follows a series of Russian-linked hacking against NATO members and warnings from intelligence services of the growing threat from China. A team of NATO experts led by none other than Madeleine Albright, the former U.S. Secretary of State, has warned that the next attack on a NATO country may well come down a fiber optic cable. A report by Albright's group said that a cyber attack on the critical infrastructure of a NATO country could equate to an armed attack justifying retaliation. So, you know, the next time some kid hacks into the power grid, a missile could be launched at his home somewhere in the world. I mean, it's a stretch. And of course, this case here doesn't have to do with hacking into a system, but it does have to do with pissing off a powerful government. And pissed off governments tend to do irrational things. Dot Red, go ahead.
Well, yeah, that's extremely disturbing. But just coming back to Manning and supposedly leaking 260,000 somewhat classified documents, how does somebody have access
to
that?
2,600 is in that number. I'm just pointing that out. It's kind of interesting.
You know, how exactly does it have access to that? Like you pointed out, it was almost like a TV thing. Just goes to a JAG folder, mm-hmm. and it's just like, oh, well, this must be interesting. You know, the whole thing about classified documents is it's supposed to be need to know. Is it even possible for him to have had access?
Well, apparently.
Lady Gaga discs.
What was that about Lady Gaga discs?
Well, that was reportedly Bradley Manning told Adrian Lamo that he would go in with a CD-RW disc, you know, a blank CD, with music files, like Lady Gaga music files on it, and then erase them and then fill it with, you know, tens of thousands of classified diplomatic cables from the U.S. government. And then take them out. He said that he would not be searched. They would just look at the disc on the way out and just say, okay, bye. He said their security was ridiculous. And I don't have the quote in front of him, but he made some comments allegedly about how ridiculously poor U.S. security was in this respect.
So he would just hide them in a different directory on the disc and leave the music files there?
I'm not sure exactly how he did it. I'm not clear on that. Yeah. But apparently they're on a CD that said Lady Gaga, among other things.
Well, you know, I gotta say, we have a lot of people here that seem to be doing what they thought was the best thing. We have, of course, Julian Assange, who continues to work with WikiLeaks and put out information that he feels should be released and known to the world, and I can't say I disagree with that. You have Adrian Lamo, who was hit with an incredibly conflicting situation and made a decision based on the information he had, and I think his motives weren't evil, but whether or not he unintentionally committed evil by doing so, that remains to be seen. And of course, you have this poor guy in the army who was going around releasing things that he felt should be seen, no doubt in the interest of justice and in the interest of full disclosure. About the only people that I think really need a good slap here are the people in charge of security of the computer systems there, because they certainly were not doing their job. The Army is not doing a very convincing job of keeping information on a need-to-know basis to the people who, quote-unquote, need to know. And I disagree about who needs to know this. I'm glad people know the classified things, because I think way too much is classified. But in this particular case, in the confines of what they're supposed to be doing, they certainly were not doing their job. So I just, you know, I hope there's a way that people can just kind of learn from this and nobody winds up having their lives ruined. But, of course, I'm naive and idealistic, and I know that's probably not going to happen. Mike?
I mean, unless, of course, the people were doing their job and Manning watched too many television shows and made the whole thing up.
In which case, okay, he lied to a lot of people.
Which is foolish.
Yeah, but you shouldn't go to prison for lying. Especially, I mean,
I just want to reiterate that Manning says he sent these documents to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks says they have no such documents, so one of them is wrong.
All right, so somebody's lying on the internet.
Yeah.
And,
so I don't know who, but
that's not a crime.
But
yet.
These are like they can't both be right.
Yeah, that's true.
That'll be hard to resolve because I'm sure WikiLeaks is going to say, "Hey, U.S. government, send somebody over and look at all the files we have on our servers to show that we don't have
yeah,
this."
Yeah, and they,
so
the
this
US
guy might go to jail for
might not wait for an invitation. That's something that so obviously we're all worried about.
Well, but this is in another country, so.
But the thing is, if the right people are doing their jobs in the first place, then we shouldn't be worried about all these classified documents falling into the wrong hands because we know that they're secure. This proves beyond anything else, apart from what's in the documents, that they are not secure. They're anything but secure. There could be 1,000 people like this who had access to it, and who knows what their intentions might be. Rob?
I'm going to disagree with you on one point. I think assuming that Manning did what he says he did, I think he needs a slap as well for opening his mouth. Okay. Because I love whistleblowers, I love what they do in general, but you know, if you do it and you're successful about it, shut your damn mouth.
Yeah, yeah. Well, especially when you're talking to somebody you don't know very well.
Yeah.
And I don't know how well the two of them knew each other, but yeah, you know. Plus, you don't an internet chat log. Who's listening to that? You know, I'm sure it wasn't very secure. I'm sure there are all kinds of ways of eavesdropping. Darrett.
Now, also, if he did in fact do this, the security thing, you know, as far as the military's fault would go, would probably go into the all too common thing of segregating computers away from everything else. I'm sure in physical real life, they wouldn't allow some guy to walk into some JAG office and start pulling out files out of, you know, file drawers, and the same kind of security really should
out
be in place.
JAG office is a real term in the Army, all right? That's just that's what they call it. What
JAG.
What does it stand for, Bernie?
Judge Attorney General.
Judge Advocate General.
A Judge Advocate General. I'm
okay,
sorry.
Yeah. So
mixing terms. I'm
yeah.
Sorry.
Well, this is certainly a controversial topic. No doubt we'll be talking about this for many weeks to come, and I'm sure it'll be something that's addressed at the conference quite a bit. And by the way, for more information on the conference, go to www.hope.net. I believe, Mike, we're opening vendor tables now for people to register?
Yes. If you are a vendor or would like to be a vendor, go to hope.net and scroll down a couple posts. You'll see the info.
And by vendor, I mean somebody who either wants to get some doctrine out to the hacker world or sell something to the hacker world, and there will be thousands of people there looking at what it is that you're offering. So it's a very good deal. It's a good way of reaching lots and lots of people. We have many people come back year after year. Okay, well, we're pretty much out of time. I really wish we could go on for a couple more hours about this, and of course we're not on next week, but I hope that the subject is still interesting when we're back next. And of course you can write to us, oth@2600.com, with your thoughts and feelings.
Or perhaps there'll be more information in 2 weeks.
I'm sure there will be.
Good.
I'm sure there will be. I'm sure we'll hear from all the parties concerned one way or another. And again, let's remind people to call in and pledge for the radio station. We've gotten a very good response. We're well over $1,000 right now. Please give us a call, 212-209-2950. What you just heard now is just a microcosm of the things that get talked about in the letters section. And by pledging $75, you'll get an autographed copy of the brand new Dear Hacker book, filled with letters to the editor of 2600 Magazine from 1984 all the way to the end of 2009. 212-209-2950, pledge of $75 gets you the autographed copy plus the off-the-hook t-shirt, and pledge of $125 gets you all of that plus 22 years of Off the Hook on DVD, 20 DVDs.
And I also want to say really quickly, because without fail we get mail about this every week, when we're, you know, we can only offer our premiums for this hour while we're live on the air.
Yes.
If at some other point in time you want to support the station and support the show, you can go to WBAI.org, and there is a mechanism on that site to donate, indicating Off the Hook as your favorite show, which we also appreciate, but we can't give you our premiums for that.
Now, Bernie, I could give you the last word so that you can get more calls coming in, because there's one on the line now. We want to make it about four or so, so go ahead. Do your stuff.
Well, again, this was a very exciting program, as many of these are, and we talk about stuff that no other radio station is going to broadcast. So I encourage our listeners to please support this kind of broadcast by calling 212-209-2950. Whatever you can pledge, please pledge. We have some great thank you gifts. Doesn't matter what they are. The main thing is that you support this radio station, WBI, for allowing this type of material to be broadcast. Free speech.
All right, good summation there. 212-209-2950. Again, $75 gets you the book. $125 gets you the book plus the audio archive. It's a great deal. Only offer tonight. Only offer for the next couple of minutes. 212-209-2950. It's Manuel for Off the Hook. See you next time. Good night.
It's false or true. I memorize every word you say. You are in tune to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. We are about to rebroadcast of a show that was played earlier with Kathy Bates and Tony Bates and Kathy Davis. Oh, Lord. Anyway, Gary Bird will be back next week, so sit back and enjoy.
Good afternoon. Happy Fun Drive, everybody. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, or just after 3 o'clock in the afternoon on WBAI 99.5 FM. I am Tony Bates. We're going to be going into a little bit more fun driving this afternoon, as you folks all know by now. And if you're still interested in getting the Gwen Scott, you can certainly call 212-209-2950 and make that pledge of support at the $150 level. This afternoon, though, we're going to look at a few more alternatives. We're going to have a guest this afternoon who has written widely on alternative medicines, natural medicines, and natural cures, because it really is, in my opinion, the way to go. Certainly, medicine used to be a little more close to nature, a little more close to home. I remember my grandmother making remedies at home. I remember simple things. I'd get stung by a bee, and she'd get some chewing tobacco and put it on my lip, and I'd watch the stinger magically come out, or I'd step on a nail, and if I'd had a tetanus shot already, I should say great-grandmother, I guess it was some combination of both of them, she'd take some pork fat and a piece of a sheet and tie that around my foot to let the poison come out. My great-grandmother certainly knew herbs to go out and pick in the field on the family land and create things. And we've gotten so far away from this that there is a movement in this country to move back toward those more holistic forms of medicine. And we focus a lot on that during the fun drive. This afternoon, we're going to have with us as a guest Dr. Cass Ingram. He is a doctor of osteopathy with a degree from the University of Osteopathic Medicine and Health Sciences. He has written many, many books. This afternoon, we're going to be focusing on a couple of them. One of them is How to Eat Right and to Live Longer. The other book that we're going to spend some time focused on is The Body Shape Diet. Dr. Cass Ingram, are you there with us?
I'm here. Great to be with you this afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. It's good to have you on WBAI's airwaves once again. The audience certainly knows you. You've been with us for many, many years. We love having you on, actually, because, you know, the audience responds very well. They speak highly of you. I was just in the phone room, in fact, speaking with one of the producers who was raving about how good the information that you present is, and was grateful that you were going to be on just this afternoon. Absolutely.
Well, good. You know, you can do so much naturally. You don't have to take drugs and toxic things. The toxic, we're in trouble because of toxins anyway, whether it's in the water or the air or in the dietary or the genetically engineered food we need to know about. Of course, I've got to inform you about that. But definitely, if we know how to do it, we can treat anything naturally. And I've done it so many times, help people in 5 minutes that have been to, you know, like 80 doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do it through the books, huh? You don't have to have me always. Well, you're going to have me for some time this afternoon, but...
Oh, yeah, we're going to get a full consultation this afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are. I would like for you to spend some time with what you just mentioned. I know that we have a producer, and I don't want to blow her cover, but she has a fantastic guest coming up right after our fun drive who has specifically written widely about... The amount of genetically modified food that we are taking in and the effects that that's having on our bodies. And his assessment is basically that we are being poisoned.
Oh, no doubt about it.
On a mass scale.
No doubt about it. And that's one of the beauties of the kind of kit that we're going to talk about here, is that I weave around the GMO foods in the diet and in the natural cures. So there's two bits of information from a take action point of view, because, you know, it's one thing to talk about the devastation and we're going to do that and the risk, but you also need a solution. So in your books that you're going to talk about today, I completely educate you on what supplements and foods you can eat that are non-GMO, that would allow you to get all the nutrients and the therapeutic medicines that you need, because genetic engineering, ladies and gentlemen, has invaded the entire category of what we ingest or drink. And they are extremely dangerous substances, whether in a beverage or a food or the pollen itself or in a supplement, okay? So it's really important to minimize the consumption of these substances. Let's put it to you flat out. When Irina Ermakova over in Russia at the Russian Academy of Sciences, and we don't want to usurp, I think it's probably Jeffrey Smith, who's a wonderful man coming up, but when she did her study, she determined that the consumption 2 weeks before they were conceived, or before conception occurred in pregnant rats, the consumption of genetically engineered Monsanto, soy, was sufficient to kill some 60% of the babies. In other words, the babies were dead. Only 40% survived.
Wow.
Now, that's bad, but what's worse, or what's just as bad, is that the 40 that did survive were all shriveled up and contorted and mutated. And you can see it on the web. You can see that Dr. Ermakova has demonstrated these photographs of a distorted rodent. So these are, and then they followed this up in Russia, finding out that the gut wall of anyone who consumes directly GMO soy or GMO corn is massively inflamed. We've got enough risks without getting sick from eating regular, what we thought would be regular food, you see.
Yeah, it's been changed, and we were not given a say in that. I know that in Europe, the population stood up and said hell no to them, that they weren't going to have that. You know, one of the producers here at WBAI, Robert Knight, recently did a show wherein the governor in this state, David Patterson, was planning to, the governor was planning to put a tax on sodas as a sugar tax for people becoming overweight. And Robert did a program pointing out that, in fact, there is no sugar in sodas, or it's primarily. It's high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
It's this genetically modified soup that we're putting into our bodies that's actually having the negative effect. And if we were actually eating real sugar, there would be, our bodies wouldn't be behaving in the same ways.
Well, this is correct. We would be much better off with regular cane sugar in a soda format than with any of the other options, which include aspartame and corn syrup. None of them are great, but if you stuck me on a desert island, or is it a deserted island? I never get that one right. If you stuck me out there somewhere, I would ask for two cases, if I had to have a soda pop, two cases of 7-Up with regular cane sugar, not beet sugar, because beet sugar is genetically engineered and would make me sick, too sick to survive. The same is true with you. You must remove the GMOs from the dietary. This is not difficult to do. This is going to be a big, powerful few hours that you're going to get on WBAI, big-time education that the government has hidden and disguised all of this from you on purpose to use your money to further their monopolies and to simultaneously cause the people to die prematurely. By the way, I must tell everyone that the life expectancy only in the United States is in decline.
Wow.
And this we attribute, it's gone from 72 or so to 67 or so, to the consumption of genetically engineered food. You often wonder why people look so dirigible-like, so bloated, so big, and bigger now than ever before. It's because the same thing happened to the rodents, to the hamsters, to the various test animals. These GMOs cause massive destruction of the intestinal membranes, and that's the beginning of, you know, and they swell the liver, they swell the spleen. It's horrifying.
They do. And so we're going to talk about eating right this hour, Doctor. We're going to look at one of your books that we have available this afternoon for a pledge of $75, which is called How to Eat Right and Live Longer. The book is filled with powerful remedies, lots of nutritional advice.
Oh, yeah.
It contains thousands of critical recommendations that might help save someone's life, but definitely can help to improve your health. You can learn in this book how to reverse aging and illnesses and stress with the foods that you eat. I'd like to start out talking about the liver. I know in the book you talk about the importance of the liver. Let's start out with what its function is and why it's so important, doctor, and then why it's important to protect it.
The liver is involved in glucose. It's involved in protein, fat. So all of that digestive manufacture stores all your vitamins, stores a certain amount of minerals, produces quite a few enzymes. And so it's really a major food factory and also a storage depot. At the same time, it ends up storing toxic substances as it attempts to detoxify and remove. And it's a big, big player in the digestion in general. Whenever a person has digestive problems, we have to look at the possibility of sluggish liver. If you're bloated, if you have a hard time with fat, if you're constipated, also if you you just don't seem to break down the food, we look at the liver because it produces bile, and bile is a way to digest fat. Plus, bile is the natural soap that the body uses. That's why if you're constipated, we look at the liver, because that soap is needed for more sort of smooth, better bowel movements.
What do you mean by the natural soap, Dr. Cass Ingram?
Well, bile is a bile salt. You know, like when they make soap, it has sodium in it, which is a sort of a saponifier. I mean, it just means that it makes the soap what it is, which it breaks down fat.
Yeah, don't you start speaking Latin at me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So you're making basically a soap that cleans the lining of your intestines and of the colon. And if you don't make enough, you get bound up, you get digestive problems. That's what it is, bile salts.
And so you talk about protecting the liver in the book. Why must we protect our livers?
Well, the liver's under massive siege from the toxic petrochemicals and all the other hydrocarbons. It's under siege from things like MSG, aspartame, drugs. The biggest siege that the liver goes through is if you're taking pharmaceuticals. Those have to be eliminated through the liver. So I'm throwing up all sorts of barriers for you in How to Eat Right and Live Longer, on using